Hello, and welcome to a fairly new podcast, considering it's the first episode, of A Trip Through the Movies. I am John Blinn, and I am joined with my co-host, Brianna McCann. Brianna, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, John. How are you today?
I'm delightful. This is a nice change of pace, I gotta say. I've been doing other podcasts at RMU for a little bit, and I've just sort of wanted to try something new. So this is going to be a nice little break.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Brianna McCann, I understand this is likely your first podcast.
Yeah, this is my first time doing this.
So what are you thinking?
You know, I'm having a nice time so far. You know, we're learning how to do this. I'm learning from the best here. I'm just excited to talk about some movies with a good friend.
I would hardly call me the best.
You're the best I know, so that counts.
Well, okay, I'll take that. I don't think there's a whole lot of competition in that, but I'll take that compliment. So I feel like because this is the first episode, we need to talk about sort of why the podcast is named what it is. And I think maybe, you know, you should be the one to explain that.
Oh, sure. I would love to do that. So as a little bit of context, John and I are in a film history class together right now this semester. And, you know, on the first day, we watch A Trip to the Moon. And so, you know, we're kind of playing off of that idea of, oh, you know, this very important, you know, film and thing in film history. But we're going back to, like, two movies that we can't necessarily go to. So we're going through history. We're going on a trip through the movies, and we're doing it together. So it's very exciting.
Exactly. We're not going to necessarily go in chronological order. But that's part of the fun, right? If you come into a new episode, if we're doing this straight through history, you know what you're going to get each week. You know, you got to keep a curveball going. You got to really spice things up. Otherwise, what's the point, right?
Absolutely. Nobody,
you don't want to watch a movie that you know the end to for the first time.
Right.
You know, you don't want to do that.
Right.
With that being said, you can't really see any movie right now. So, you know, this gives you something to watch at home. I mean, you could go to the movies right now, but, like, who wants to?
Right. We wouldn't recommend it.
Exactly. What if I can stream new movies coming out on HBO Max? I don't want to do that.
Right.
I don't want to do that. Because for whatever reason, right, and this is just a conversation I want to have before we dive into our movie here, because I feel like this is an important conversation to have.
Absolutely.
For whatever reason, you know, before COVID-19 hit, super stoked to go to movies. I see the trailer. I'm excited to go see them. And the example that I am using that's coming to mind for me right now is the Wonder Woman movie, right? The first one that was advertised and came out. I was super excited to go see it. I was really stoked. I went and saw the movie while it was in theaters. I think I saw it twice because I took my brother to see it a second time after I saw it with some friends. And you had that excitement. And I remember before COVID hit, they had their Wonder Woman 1984 trailer coming out, and I was equally excited. However, as time progressed, you know, COVID hit, and suddenly it's released on HBO Max. That's the route they decided to take. And I gotta say, despite the fact that I was excited for that movie to be released, and, you know, it was very similar to the excitement I felt for the first one, I still haven't watched it. And I've had it in my living room for how long? So, I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, there's something to be said for the fact that, you know, part of going to the movies is the experience of going to the movies. And so, you know, yeah, it's great that you can see this movie that you wanted to see, but it wasn't necessarily always about the movie. And sometimes, you know, I've been struggling with this. Like, it's hard to find the motivation to watch something sometimes. You know, there's so much going on in the world that you're just so beat down by it. Sometimes it's hard to find the motivation in this sort of environment.
And I find that it's easier to... I feel that, like, when you're watching a movie that you care about or a movie that's important, whether it be in the cinematic history aspect or just you care about it personally or you expect to care about it because if you haven't seen it before, you don't know if you're going to care about it or not. I find that if it's an important movie that you want to watch, then it's like, okay, I have to pick a time where it's like I can give this my undivided attention and I want this experience to be good. And when you're doing that at home, for whatever reason, that's hard to find.
Right. Like, you have your phone right there. You have all these distractions that you don't have in a movie theater, and it's really hard to focus. Absolutely.
So, like, if I go back into my Letterboxd, which if you don't have a Letterboxd, then check it out.
Get one, please. Follow us.
But if I go back through it, I see all these movies from the month of January, December, and there's a ton of them But I'm like, man, only like two of these I really cared about, because I just burned through them with friends or was casual watching. And it's just, it's interesting to look at that, because that's just the way the world is right now. It's interesting.
Absolutely.
Do you know what else was interesting? Brandon McCann.
What? What, John Blaine?
Strangers on a Train.
Woo!
By Alfred Hitchcock. Came out in 1951, and I gotta say, it was pretty good.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
I think it was a good start to this.
Yeah.
And if there's anyone that I know who's gonna know more about this than me, it's you. So I sort of want to let you take the lead here, and I'll just sort of pop in a little bit on, you know, the pre-context, if you will, to Strangers on a Train.
Thank you for that setup, John, hyping me up there. I appreciate it. So Strangers on a Train, just a little bit of background information, you know, on this movie. This is really a great Hitchcock, and for any of you who don't know, this is John's first Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I had a history of TV and video class last semester, and we watched one episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which is just like an anthology series that he does. But it just didn't feel like I needed the movie experience, you know, because that's what he's better known for.
Absolutely. And this is a great one to start with. So as you said, this came out in 1951. It's adapted from a 1950 novel by Patricia Highsmith. It was shot in the autumn of 1950 and released by Warner Brothers on June 30th, 1951. So this movie stars Farley Granger, Robert Walker, Ruth Roman, Patricia Hitchcock, who is the daughter of the director. And additionally, this movie, interestingly enough, is number 32 on the American Film Institute's 100 Years, 100 Thrills list. So this is definitely an interesting Hitchcock to talk about, and especially one to start with a Hitchcock first-timer here.
I want to say the thing that stands out the most to me on this pre-production part is the fact that the novel came out in 1950, and in just a year, they had produced this movie. And we're talking 50s level of technology. So it's amazing to think, and it is a rather simple movie in terms of plot and what you would need to produce your movie there. But I have to say, that's impressive.
It really is. When I was reading through that, like in research for the show, that's like incredible how fast they turned this around. And especially considering, you know, Patricia Highsmith would go on to be known for writing kind of novels like this. But this was the first novel she ever wrote. So like right off the bat, somebody's like, hey, we want to make a movie out of this, which is crazy. Like, good for her.
And also, I mean, I'm assuming Alfred Hitchcock is the one who read the novel. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm wrong to assume that. But someone had to read the book. And like, that alone, if you're making movies, where do you find the time to read a book? All right. You got to read the script.
Time.
Exactly. So I really don't. I'm fascinated by the fact that that's only been a year.
Right.
And I guess that should really sort of demonstrate how skilled Alfred Hitchcock is. And these people who, I mean, obviously the actors, if the actors aren't doing a good enough job to meet Hitchcock's image, then it's going to take even longer.
Right.
So that just goes to show you how great they were at what they did.
Absolutely.
And going off of that, we sort of wanted to dive into what these actors and directors were like at this time. And to provide some context to that, I'm just going to read the Letterboxd description here. So you sort of know who everyone is, what they're doing, and how they fit this image. So the Letterboxd says it starts with a shriek of a train whistle. And ends with shrieking excitement. A psychotic socialite confronts a pro tennis star with a theory on how two complete strangers can get away with murder, a theory that he plans to implement. So you have your sociopath, if you will, Bruno, and I can't remember Bruno Antony, that's his last name. And you have your tennis player, Guy Haynes. And to provide some context here, just because we have to give a little bit in order to truly understand what the actors are going for here. Guy Haynes sort of, you know, everything's going well for him. He's on top of the world. He's a tennis star. Well, not everything's going well for him. But in terms of who he is, he's a very basic, successful man, a basic, successful athlete. But he does have one problem, as I sort of touched upon there, and that is that he's currently going through a divorce. He's been going through this divorce for quite a while. His wife was cheating on him, and, you know, he knew his marriage was over. He ends up tangled in another relationship, and he wants to finish his divorce and move on to marry this next woman, who is played by Ruth Roman, correct?
Yeah, good job.
But he runs into a bigger problem on a train ride. Strangers on a train, who would have guessed? a man by the name of Bruno. Bruno is just having conversation with him. He seems to know a little bit more about Guy Haines than, you know, maybe Guy Haines would like him to. But hey, that's the life of a celebrity. So Bruno goes on to pitch him this idea. He said, man, sure would be nice if your wife, who is taking forever to divorce you, was just out of the picture, right? Out of the motion picture.
Good one.
So he says, you know, like, let's just kill her. And Guy Haines, he's a tennis star. He doesn't have it in him to murder someone. All right, listen. Would you ever expect a tennis player to have it in them to murder someone?
That would be really surprising.
Wait, you know what? Okay, I'm going to backtrack on that statement. Serena Williams could totally kill someone.
That's true.
You know what? And she's a very successful woman, and that's not to speak ill of her character, but I feel like she could do it.
She's very powerful.
She's fantastic.
Yeah.
But Guy Haines, not Serena Williams. He doesn't have it in him.
No, he doesn't even look that good of a tennis player.
So Bruno tells him, Guy, you know, if you killed your wife, you'd get caught right off the bat because you have the motive. It's a very clear motive. But if I killed your wife, you know, no one would ever know. As long as someone sees you out and about, you know, you're in the clear. And Guy Haines sort of brushes him off. But Bruno doesn't have his fill. So he goes, and I'm sure you can sort of see where this is going. But we'll dive there later. And as you can see, Bruno is, he's not all together. He's not all there. And, of course, this image is all brought to life by the famous and, you know, you could arguably say infamous. You know, anyone who paints these horrible pictures is somewhat infamous. And, Brianna, I'm sort of going to let you take the leads and tell us a little bit more about this infamous man who made this picture come to be.
Sure. So Strangers on a Train is directed by Alfred Hitchcock, who I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you've probably at least heard of. You have some level of interest. But so Sir Alfred Joseph Hitchcock was born August 13th, 1889, and died April 29th, 1980. So he's called the master of suspense because of, just like John was talking about, this image that he cultivates and this atmosphere that you see in his movies, that he really does master the element of suspense as we know it. In his lifetime, he directed over 50 feature films in a career that spanned 60 years. He hosted and produced the television anthology series Alfred Hitchcock Presents that John mentioned earlier. And what's interesting is just kind of looking at his career, it's almost hard to believe, like, just what he accomplished. He garnered 46 Academy Awards nominations with 6 wins, although never for Best Director, which is one of those things that you hear and you're like, wow, he never won an Oscar for Best Director. But he started his career with, like, actually as a title card designer for silent films. And then his first successful film in 1927, The Lodger, A Story of the London Fog, which is also a tremendous movie if we're just throwing recommendations out there. but it really helped to shape the thriller genre. So by the late 30s, he's starting to have international acclaim with movies like The 39 Steps and The Lady Vanishes. So then producer David O. Selznick persuaded him to move to Hollywood in 1939, which is where we start to see him have the string of successful films like Rebecca in 1940, which wins Best Picture, and then movies like Foreign Correspondent, Shadow of a Doubt, Notorious. But in the late 40s, you know, he's having a brief lull of commercial success, and that is where Strangers on a Train comes in 1951. And so this is kind of the film where he returns to form. And after Strangers on a Train, between 1954 and 1960, he goes on to direct 4 films that are often ranked among the all-time greatest and typically regarded as his best: Rear Window in 1954, Vertigo in 1958, North by Northwest in 1959, and Psycho in 1960. So in that way, Strangers on a Train is a really interesting one to talk about and an interesting one to start this podcast with. Because of the fact that it is this kind of middle-of-the-road point between early Hitchcock and the things that go on to become some of his best-known works.
So it's a nice dive into him. And as you're describing him, I have to think, and I feel like this is worth acknowledging, I feel like for whatever reason, every once in a while, you get these insanely horrifically creative horror masterminds that just come and they master some sort of medium, right? And I'm thinking, at first I thought, you know, Alfred Hitchcock is sort of like the Stephen King of movies.
Definitely.
Right? But yeah. Maybe Stephen King and Alfred Hitchcock came first. So you have to say that there had to have been inspiration there. Maybe Stephen King is the Alfred Hitchcock of books. But it's really fascinating because, you know, you think about these guys, you think about Edgar Allan Poe, you think about Alfred Hitchcock, you think of Stephen King, and it's just like, how can these people make stuff like this? And, you know, while Strangers on a Train isn't terribly violent, in the 50s, some of the things you saw in this movie, that would blow your mind. You know, we're so attuned to violence right now that it's fascinating, you know, that this guy was able to paint this picture and probably scare the hell out of everyone in the 1950s.
Absolutely.
So I really just don't know how these people come to be. Yeah. And I mean, Stephen King did a lot of cocaine in his writing. I haven't heard anything of Alfred Hitchcock doing drugs, but it's fascinating to think about. And he brought this image to life. Obviously, the guy's a genius.
Yes.
An evil genius. But not evil in the sense of he's inherently causing damage, but
right.
Evil in what he makes.
Yeah.
And he had two very talented people to go alongside of him. And I want to start with the more interesting of the two, is Robert Walker, who was born in 1918 and plays the role of Bruno. Now, as we mentioned, Hitchcock is sort of a genius in making his pictures come to life. And at the time, Robert Walker had been to a psychiatric. He had been taken into psychiatric care before this movie. He had struggled with family issues in his past, and he was an alcoholic. He had been through several divorces in his lifetime. So if you look at who Robert Walker was and what his life was like, and you see him play the role of Bruno, this very sort of unstable character, it makes a lot of sense. And this is not to discredit his successes, because he was very successful. He had a very charismatic and boyish persona that really sort of helped him out. In his first successes, you see in a film called Winter Carnival, which came out in 1939, and two Lana Turner films that were directed at MGM called These Glamour Girls and Dancing Co-Ed. So, again, you sort of see that boyish charm playing into those movies. Obviously not, you know, a Strangers on a Train type of direction. He also did some work in radio. He co-starred in a weekly show, Maudie's Diary, from August 1941 to September 1942. And, you know, at this time, if you look at that time in history, 40s, obviously radio is... It's right as radio's in its prime, just before TV sort of starts to take over. So that's a huge deal. And I think we should not discredit that, because I feel like nowadays, hey, what, you're on the radio? Everyone has a podcast nowadays.
What do you mean?
Yeah, exactly. But it's fascinating that you look at this guy and you have this very successful man, but also one who struggles. And when you look at Bruno, he's exactly that. And whether I wouldn't say Bruno was inherently successful. He was born into success, so he had that going for him. But really a perfect caster, really just perfectly fits the role. Unfortunately, he does succumb to his alcoholism, and he dies later on because of that on August 28th, 1951. So he dies rather young, and you hate to see it because, like I said, despite his struggles, he really is successful. And when you have someone in the Hollywood world who has that charisma, has that, like, just charm that you're looking for, they're obviously going to do very, very well in that industry. And he plays the role of Bruno brilliantly, so yeah. It would have been lovely to see him do more. So we're going to move on to our, you know, less kind of a bummer. Farley Granger, who plays the role of Guy, and we'll just sort of take a look at the information here. He was born on July 1st, 1925, and he lives all the way until March 27th, 2011. So, Brandy, you and I had some Farley Granger in our lives.
We did.
And I did not know that until until I started looking into this. And he is, according to Wikipedia, but, you know, best known for his two collaborations with Alfred Hitchcock in Rope and Strangers on a Train. Coincidentally enough, we were going to watch Rope rather than Strangers on a Train before we discovered that we didn't have access to it as easily as we would have Strangers on a Train. Granger was first noticed in a small stage production in Hollywood by a Goldwyn casting director and given a significant role in The North Star, a conversational film praising the Soviet Union at the height of World War II. So,
we're right before the Hollywood blacklist, so we still have a couple our wartime allies.
But later condemned for its political bias. So, you know, Farley Granger is probably part of that condemned. Mm-hmm. Another war film, The Purple Heart, followed before Grange's naval service in Honolulu. So he's a veteran in a union that arranged troop entertainment in the Pacific. Question for my history buff over there.
Yes.
Were we being cool? Was the United States being cool in Hawaii around this time? Were we being all right, or were we causing trouble over there at that time?
It wasn't a state yet, but it was very near to being a state. So it was basically like ours at that time, which, you know, like at that point, we had already toppled the monarchy there several decades ago. It was basically ours.
So could we just pretend that Farley Granger wasn't doing anything shady in Hawaii at the time?
Yes.
Okay.
From what you said, I mean, if he was organizing troop entertainment, that would have been like, you know, USO kind of things. Like, he's not doing anything.
I couldn't remember where those timelines matched up, and I was curious.
No, I think he's okay.
Sort of like Hawaii, things start to look up for Farley Granger in 1948. Well, I don't know if it looked up for Hawaii in 1948, but things do look up for Hawaii. Hitchcock casts him in Rope, a fictionalized account of the Leopold and Loeb murder case. I apologize if I didn't get that right, which earned mixed reviews. What?
Yeah, I was hoping we would get to watch this one because you would really love, you know, it's really one of the first movies to try and do this one-shot style that, you know, if any of you have seen 1917 most recently that did that, but, you know, there was just kind of a lot of, well, did that work, did it didn't, and it just kind of got mixed reviews as a result of some of those technical attempts, but it's really good.
It definitely sounds worth checking out, especially, you know, given what I saw in watching this one. But yeah, well, maybe we'll find a way to visit that one.
We will.
We'll get there. So basically, after that point, he's very successful, well into his 70s. He works. He ranged from classical drama on Broadway to several Italian language films and major documentaries about Hollywood. He tended to find fault with his directors and scriptwriters, however, and his career remains defined by the two Hitchcock films, which leads me to think, if he had issues with directors, there's a chance he fought with Alfred Hitchcock. That makes me think there are either one or two ways that goes. If I'm arguing with Alfred Hitchcock, I'm either one, terrified, or two, laughing because he kind of looks hilarious. He kind of looks like the human version of Eeyore.
Oh my gosh. Well, I can't unsee that now, John, but you're not wrong.
Just to wrap things up, and I feel bad going into this laughing, Granger dies in 2011 at the age of 85, and just natural causes, peaceful. And as I mentioned, so really surprising that something so early actually lasted in our lifetimes. Wish I was, you know, able to comprehend film, like, in old movies at that time,
right.
But I was 11 and probably didn't care because it didn't have color.
Very fair. I didn't at that time either. I won't pretend I was always like this.
I hadn't been inspired by a podcast made by two college students yet.
Oh, wow. Incredible.
But those are your two lead roles in that one, and they both play their roles exceptionally well. I'm engaged in their characters the entire time. And really just looking at Bruno and how he is portrayed in that movie, I think that's some of the best acting that you'll ever see. But he, again, might not have even really been acting. He just fit the role that well.
Absolutely. And I think that's such an inspired choice to cast Robert Walker there, because of the fact that he has the experience of, you know, that lived experience that kind of matches that. But at the same time, like you mentioned, he had this boyish charm that you see in some of these movies, that then all of a sudden for him to be this like psychotic killer, it's really an interesting kind of subversion of that. But the boyish charm plays into this like kind of youthful innocence that it seems like Bruno has. I think that, like you said, it's some of the best acting you'll ever see, Robert Walker, in this film, certainly.
So with that being said, obviously we've sort of hinted that we feel that the movie is good. but let's go a little more in depth. What did you think? What thoughts did you take away from this viewing? Because I understand that you've seen this movie before.
Yeah, so I watched this movie for the first time probably about like a year and a half ago. And I love this movie. I think this is one of Hitchcock's best movies. And there's just so many different parts of this movie. Like, there's a lot going on here, because like you said, on the surface it's kind of a simple plot. Like, it's really not, it's one of his, you know, easier movies to kind of summarize in like 10 seconds. But the thing that I like about this movie that I really just kind of picked up on yesterday, in the original book that this is based off of, Farley Granger's character is actually an architect, but Hitchcock changes that to be a he doesn't change it. It was actually his wife and two other women that wrote the screenplay for it, so they changed it. But that he became a tennis player. And it's such a fascinating choice to do that, because then there kind of becomes this interplay in this movie that, oh, okay, tennis, the idea of two people hitting a ball back and forth. Well, that's exactly what this movie is. It's just one, like, significantly more deadly and messed up game of tennis, but it's a game of tennis, like two people back and forth. And so just kind of the way that this movie plays with that idea of, you know, interplay between two people is really fascinating. And I think it's one of the best movies that kind of explores a dynamic between two people that's not necessarily like a romantic dynamic.
And I hadn't really thought about that tennis analogy until I trickled into your Letterboxd review after I watched the movie, because I knew we were going to talk about this today. But I hadn't really thought that much about it when I was watching, but now that it's in the light and we're discussing it, I have to say it's particularly interesting when there's a scene where Guy is playing tennis and Bruno is in the crowd of this tennis match, and every person in the audience is moving their head side to side watching the ball go back and forth, and Bruno is just staring Guy down. And it's terrifying. It is. And it's such a simple shot. But when you watch that analogy, because, you know, it's the simple back and forth. But when you break it down, like in the tennis of Guy's life, he's got that flow. He's got that steady sort of motion. He's just going about life. And then you got Bruno just staring right through. He's staring right through that facade of, well, I'm just a tennis guy. I just go with the flow. No. You got this divorce. You got secrets. You're just like everyone else. And it's so powerful. It's so simple, but it's terrifying because of that. It's definitely something that I didn't think about until you mentioned it. So I'm glad you mentioned it. At first, I was just like, that's terrifying. But now I'm like, you know, they clearly thought that out.
Right. There's so much of that, you know, kind of once you start to look at it through that lens of like, okay, like what's the symbolism of that? You see a lot more of that. And something else I really noticed is later during that last tennis match before the final like confrontation, the announcer is saying things like, I have the direct quote here, Guy Haines is a quiet, methodical player, almost lackadaisical. As a rule, he plays slowly between points, well within himself. But then he goes on to say, well, now he's hitting harder. He's hurrying up the play. He's taking chances I've never seen him take. This is a complete reversal of his usual watch and wait strategy. So even in lines like that that feel like a throwaway, all of a sudden you're seeing this, oh, wait, that connects to this approach that he's now taking to Bruno and this approach he's taking in his life. Like, it's just, man, the devil works hard, but Alfred Hitchcock works harder.
There's while we're on the topic of very small details here that were clearly thought out very well, there is a scene where Bruno is pursuing a particular character at a carnival, and they get on this boat ride to go on to the Tunnel of Love ride, where it's like Garfield's Nightmare. Rest in peace, Garfield's Nightmare.
Any Pittsburghers out there, you know.
But as the person that Bruno is pursuing gets on the boat and sort of takes off, there are vendors all throughout the carnival that are chanting, like, oh, step right up, come get your prize. As soon as she takes off from the dock, one of the vendors in the back starts chanting, hurry, 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 kind of deal. And it's very faint, and it's as soon as she leaves. And I was like, I don't know if that's intentional or if that is just, like, they got lucky. But, you know, if you're being pursued by some guy who, at the time, you really don't know if she means her harm. Or if Bruno means any harm in this situation. But as soon as that, I noticed that, I was like, oh, he means harm.
I didn't even notice that. Oh, my gosh.
It's very faint. And I part of the reason I think it was an accident is because that's the last time anything like that happens. But Alfred Hitchcock, maybe you got really lucky. But just for the sake of this being my first movie with him, and I want to be impressed, and I was impressed, but I'll pretend that was done intentionally.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I mean, I just think this, you know, this movie is such an interesting one, because whenever you talk about Hitchcock, people often think of, you know, Psycho, North by Northwest, Vertigo, things like that, the things that come after this movie. But this movie is, in my mind at least, one of Hitchcock's best, because it is. It's so methodical. It's so well thought out. But it doesn't lose itself in being convoluted in the plot in any way. Because I feel like sometimes, you know, even if I like them, some of his movies succumb to that. But there's something really great about the fact that there's a lot of simplicity in this movie that then really the actors are given the chance to, you know, kind of explore that more fully and kind of make those roles something bigger, because they're not necessarily beholden to, well, here's a lot of twists and turns and a really convoluted plot. So like you said, I mean, I think in Strangers on a Train, Farley Granger and Robert Walker give some of the best performances I've seen in a Hitchcock movie. Because, like, you know, we talk a lot about Robert Walker, and he's done so, you know, the things he brings to this role are pretty incredible. And it's a shame, you know, we don't get to see him do more things like this. But Farley Granger is doing so well playing off of him. Like, the way he plays just being that, like, nervous, uncomfortable, like, haha, you're kind of weird, but I have to be nice to you at the beginning is so good. And I think that that's really, you know, an interesting thing that this, you know, this Hitchcock movie, more so than some of his other ones, is carried on performances rather than, you know, a convoluted plot.
And it has to be, because it's such a simple story. And one thing that I wanted to mention, though, is despite the simplicity of the story here, and I have to wonder if it's because of this movie, if you look at a lot of modern thrillers today, you see this sort of back and forth and simple just, as they say in the movie, crisscross sort of plot line. And the movie that came to mind for me was The Gift. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie.
No.
It came out not long ago, 2010s, I think. But you have this guy, he runs into a friend from college or high school or one of the two. It's been a little bit since I've seen it. But he's nice to him, and he's sort of intruding in his life, trickling in little by little. And it's very similar to this movie. And that's the one that came to mind. But I've seen a lot of thrillers just with friends over the summer and throughout quarantine. We'll be playing Xbox. And we're like, okay, let's watch a movie on Netflix real fast. And we'll watch thrillers. That's always what they pick. So I've seen a lot of recent ones. And I got to say, there is a reoccurring pattern here. But, and this could be because I'm a noob at classical movies, but I haven't really seen anything before that, or before Strangers on a Train, that replicates that. So you have to wonder, did this movie lay the groundwork for modern thrillers?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, because, you know, we see Hitchcock be the master of suspense. You know, while there are some inklings of a suspense or horror genre before, you know, like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, John and I are in a film history class together. And just last week, we watched The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And so you see, you know, the beginnings of a horror genre or a suspense genre. But it's really Hitchcock that takes this and develops suspense. So yeah, you're right. Like, movies like Strangers on a Train that kind of introduce new ways of having characters interact within a horror or suspense storyline really is Hitchcock pioneering this and pioneering it in a way that's not just, you know, a pulp film, but a film that's something really artful and significant.
One thing that I wanted to mention before we sort of take a deep dive into the movie for anyone who wants to know what happens, maybe doesn't have the time to watch it, whatever, is that the beginning introduces these crossing paths brilliantly, because you have two pairs of shoes, two different people, Bruno and Guy, and the movie starts off just following their shoes, following their literal paths to meet each other on this train. And you don't see these characters for a minute or so, just their shoes and the paths. And they get on the train and immediately they graze shoes. And as soon as their shoes graze, they start interacting. And I want to go back and look. I'm not sure who moves their foot to start the interaction.
Oh.
Because if it's Bruno, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But if it's Guy, I think that is way more interesting. Because just by moving his foot, Guy inherently brings upon all this to himself. So it's like, it's subtle, and I'm definitely overthinking it. But in one way, it's like, oh, maybe Guy really wanted what happened to happen. Maybe he knew.
Ooh.
But yeah, with that being said, just interesting subtlety. And he makes you think about these small little details with stuff like that. And I think that's all I want to add on a technical aspect. The movie's a lot of fun to watch. It doesn't really drag on. Because I saw it, and again, with the simplicity of the plot, and I saw this like almost 2-hour runtime, and I was like, all right. This might start to get a little dry. It doesn't, really, because little things start to be incorporated here and there that add on to it without ruining the easiness of it, the flow of it. So overall, I would recommend it. I gave it like a 4 or 4.5 out of 5 on Letterboxd. And I believe you did the same?
Yeah, I gave it 4.5 on Letterboxd, which is up from the first time I watched it that I gave it 4. So there's that.
So with that being said, I want to take a final walk, just write down the plot of the movie. We'll touch upon all the key points briefly, and then we'll call it an episode. All right, so as we mentioned, and feel free to hop in whenever you do, because I might skip points or anything like that.
I have the Wikipedia up in front of me, so we'll just
So we sort of touched upon earlier on in the episode what happens on the train. Bruno mentions that while Guy would want his wife dead, Bruno doesn't particularly care for his dad. He's okay if dad's out of the picture. So he's like, hey, you can kill my dad, and naturally Guy's like, I'm not gonna kill your dad. Like, what are you talking about? Get out of here. So Guy is going to meet his wife, and he runs into her at, I think it's her place of work, correct?
Yeah.
And he says, all right, when do we meet your lawyer? When do we finalize this divorce? Let's make this happen. And she says, meh.
Yeah, I'm not like literally.
Yeah. I'm not getting a divorce. Meh.
Yeah.
The hell with your divorce.
Right. And she's also pregnant at the time, but like with somebody else's baby.
She's the worst.
Yeah.
She really is the worst.
Genuinely the worst.
So, Guy's like, well, this sucks because you wanted the divorce. You were cheating on me. You're the worst. I wish you were dead. I wish you got murdered. Yep. And you know what? She does. She gets murdered.
Yeah. Shortly
after this exchange, Bruno looks up and his wife, Marion is his wife's name, correct? Or is it Miriam?
Miriam.
Miriam.
Yeah. If they sounded the same, you were fine.
He looks up Miriam in the phone book. He follows her to a carnival as she's out with her...
Yeah, it's like two other guys.
Two other guys. I don't know. They're just hanging out, maybe.
I don't know what that relationship is.
Probably not Guy's favorite relationship. Yeah. I'm sure he could do without those guys.
Those two guys, yeah.
He follows her into this carnival scene, and I have to say, the carnival scene is crazy to me. Mm-hmm. because he's following Marion and she sees him. And at first I'm like, oh, she's afraid. But then she starts like,
flirting with him.
He's so goofy. And like Bruno just goes over. There's this one part in the carnival scene where he slams down the weight with your hammer. And oh, it's if you're so strong, if it hits the bell. Mm-hmm. And naturally Bruno's hits the bell,
right.
Which I call BS on that. There's no way. Bruno's a big mama's boy, all right? You think he's going to the gym? No, he's just going around bothering people on trains. He's a nuisance.
As a word of advice with that, though, ladies, if there is a guy that looks like that and goes and does that at a carnival and hits the thing and rings the bell, run away. Please just leave immediately. Don't do what good old Miriam does here.
So Miriam's like, hee-hee-hee. Like, I'd be scared. He's following you. Yeah. You've never seen him before. But whatever. It was the 50s.
It was the 50s. Fair enough.
I'm going to have to ask my grandma. Grandma.
Did a man stalk you at a carnival? And what did you do?
And she's like, oh, yeah, it was Pap.
Oh, my God.
So they go on the Tunnel of Love, as I sort of touched upon earlier before. Bruno takes the boat behind this trio, and this scene rocks. You have that hurry, hurry behind them, and then there's this shot of Mirian's boat and Bruno's just behind them. And Bruno has this fedora on, and it makes it very obvious that it's him. And I think that shot in particular is why they even put him in a fedora in the first place.
Yeah.
But his shadow overcomes Mirian's boat for just however it was shot. That's what happens. And then immediately it cuts to the end of the Tunnel of Love, but you cannot see anyone in it. And you hear Mirian cry out. But then as they float out, she starts laughing. And it's just the guys in the boat that she's with tickling her. But the minute, it's like shadow, scream of fear, scream of laughter. And it's so well done. It rocks. They end up taking this boat to the other side of an island.
Yeah.
Which...
I'm not sure the logistics of that.
I wasn't alive in the 50s. I'm not sure if it was cool for them to just take the boat wherever, but they did. And Bruno runs into Mirian. He lights a lighter right in front of her face, which, again, not threatened. Mirian's like, hee hee.
Right? Awesome. Again, warning sign, ladies. Yeah. Red flag.
And then he strangles her to death. To be blunt, he straight up strangles her to death.
In another shot that is rad.
You want to talk about that?
Oh, sure. I'll talk about that shot. So, yeah, again, any of you that have seen this movie, whenever he is strangling Miriam, the shot is actually framed in Miriam's glasses that he has knocked off of her that are on the ground. And that is how you see the entire action of him strangling her. And it's absolutely wild, like, how they did this. And, if you're interested in hearing more about how logistically they did it, it's on Wikipedia. But, like, all of a sudden, as John just mentioned, you hear her screaming, this absolutely, like, mind-blowing shot. And then all of a sudden, it's complete silence the whole time he's strangling her. And it's in the glasses frame. And there aren't many shots in movies that are better than that.
It's, I would argue, it's the best shot I've ever seen of someone getting strangled to death.
I'm glad you've seen multiple.
So, Bruno, thinking he's the hero of the day, post-murder, goes to Guy's house as Guy's getting home from, I don't know what he was doing, tennis?
Probably.
Yeah, all he does is tennis.
Guy stuff.
Guys, hanging out with the bros. Yeah.
Oh.
And he's like, oh, yeah, I totally killed Mirian. He gives Guy her shattered glasses where we just had that chilling shot. And the glasses end up playing an interesting role in this movie that I don't think I'm going to dive too in-depth on unless you feel that we should.
We're probably okay.
The only detail that I want to add about that is it will come later on. He gives Guy Mirian's glasses as proof, and... Guy's, he's like, well, now you got to kill my dad. And Guy's like, I didn't ask you to kill my wife. And like, and he seems more annoyed that now he's in this predicament than he is that his wife is dead.
He wasn't really that upset about that.
Which, like, his wife's kind of the worst.
Right.
So, like, I can't say that, like, if I were in his shoes, I'd be happy. But also, like, I get it.
You're really incriminating yourself right now.
I promise. I'm not a killer. I'm not a Bruno. For the record, not a Bruno. See, this is what Alfred Hitchcock does. This is right. What he wanted.
Now we're wondering if we are.
Now we're wondering if we're murderers. So he leaves. The cops show up to Guy's house. Guy's like hanging out, and I don't really want the cops to see me right now. So the cops leave. Guy goes up. His new lover, whose name escapes me at the moment, I cannot remember.
Anne.
Oh, wow, the simplest of names, and I managed to forget it. Anne calls him. My family wants to see you right now. You need to come over here. So he goes, cool. I'll come over. He goes over, and Anne's father, who's a senator, has all these resources, probably in the police department and such, tells Guy, hey, your wife's dead. And then they all just react in the worst way possible. Anne has a younger sister named Barbara. Barbara should have been prime suspect number one. Number one! Because very she's true. Way too excited about this guy's wife being dead. She's like, oh, what? Yeah, when's the wedding? I would love to have a guy who'd murder for me. And it just blew my mind.
The part that I love about that is the fact that the role of her sister Barbara is played by Alfred Hitchcock's daughter. That's literally, I feel like, what Alfred Hitchcock would say in that sort of situation. And he says, here, daughter, you will be this.
Like, she is just the worst.
But she's, like, the best character in the same way because of that.
It's amusing. It really is. But also, man.
Weird reaction.
Yeah, try better. try to not be so excited about dead people. Guy finds out officially that his wife is dead. And then you sort of have, and this goes on for a while, but it's really nothing like that you wouldn't expect. Mm-hmm. The cops are obviously like, okay, obviously you're suspect number one. We're going to bring you in for questions because it's your dead wife and she sucked. So let's talk about it. You have this guy's like, oh, I was on the train at the time of the murder. I met this professor. I talked to him. He can testify for me. And the professor's like, nah, I was way too drunk to remember any of that. And it doesn't work out for Guy. They send a police officer to tail him, hang out with him, be buds, swim in the pool, go hang out, have some beers. And that cop's pretty cool. I gotta say.
He was a pretty cool cop.
He's a good character. Yeah. Because he's sort of like skeptical or less skeptical of Guy is what I want to say.
Right.
Just as he gets to know him. Also, in terms of Professor, this quote is amazing. Guy goes back to Anne, and Anne's like, oh, so your name should be cleared now because of that professor, right? And or you now you have an alibi. And Guy says, when an alibi is full of bourbon, it can't stand up. What a line.
That is such a good line.
So things start to go awry. Guy starts hanging. Bruno keeps bothering Guy. He won't go away. He's like a sickness. And Bruno keeps bothering Guy. And it sort of goes on and on. He's just trying to peer pressure him into killing his dad. You know, they tell you don't let peer pressure convince you to do drugs. Don't let peer pressure convince you to kill someone else's dad. I think that's the lesson. Give away one lesson from this, let it be don't let your friends tell you or don't let strangers on a train tell you to kill your dad. Yeah. Or their dad, I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's a good lesson. I like that.
So eventually he reaches this point where it looks like Guy is going to go kill Bruno's dad. He sneaks into the house, and he, right before it looks like he's going to kill him, he's like, oh, Mr. Bruno's dad, wake up. Your son wants me to kill you. And sure enough, the light turns on, and it's Bruno sleeping in his dad's bed, which is kind of weird. I wouldn't want to sleep in my dad's bed.
He's also in a full tuxedo, too. Like, it's really, it's kind of a weird shot, but it's really, like, you laugh, but you shouldn't write that.
So Bruno says, well, now you did it. Now I know you're going to betray me. So it's on. And Guy has to go play the tennis game that we mentioned about earlier. And Bruno thinks, well, now is the perfect time for me to go plant evidence at the scene of the murder that belongs to Guy. He has a lighter that belongs to Guy. He goes to the scene of the murder. He's on his way there, going back to the carnival. He drops the lighter in a storm drill like a big fool, and managed to fish it out with his hands, which, how small were his hands that he could do that?
A good question.
guy, for whatever reason, decides to play his whole tennis game rather than leaving because he's like, well, it's going to be suspicious if I don't do it. But then he runs away after. He runs from the cops after the tennis game. I'm like, that's suspicious.
That was more suspicious than you not playing.
So he's going. He knows that Bruno is going to plant this evidence. He knows it. And what ends up happening is Bruno is waiting in line for the boats again so he can get back to the island. As Bruno is waiting in line, there is a witness who saw him initially take the boat in the first place who recognizes him. And the cops, who are there for Guy, who also know that Guy is going to the carnival, are alerted by this witness, hey, the guy who murdered that woman is here. And they start to sort of move in. And there's this really... This really sort of got my attention because when you're watching Bruno in the first carnival scene, he's got this very predatory energy. But in the second scene, they shoot him like prey in a nature documentary. He's jittery. His eyes are all over the place. He knows the jig is up. The cops make their move on Bruno, and they also happen to run into Guy there. And as they're making their move, Guy and Bruno stumble their way onto a merry-go-round. And the cops shoot at one of them, I don't know who, and also what terrible but also surprisingly good aim these guys have.
Because there were children on there right then, too.
Yeah, exactly.
There were other people there.
They're just shooting onto the merry-go-round. And they kill the conductor of the conductor, I don't know if that's the right word. They kill the guy in charge of the merry-go-round. He falls over, and suddenly this merry-go-round is going way too fast.
Yes.
So here's a question I want to ask you before we dive into the end of the movie.
Yes.
Does that look fun when the merry-go-round is going way too fast, or would you be terrified? Do you think you'd get sick, or would you have a good time?
I think a mix of both. And I think it also hurts the context of the fact that they're literally fighting for their lives. But, like, if it were just, like, you and I hanging out on a merry-go-round going way too fast, I think I might be, like, scared, but it might be fun. I don't know. Or if we were shooting at each other, it might be different.
That's fair. I'll take that, honestly. I hope you never shoot at me while I'm on a merry-go-round that's going way too fast. I'll put that out there. I don't think that'd be fun.
There's a first time for everything, John.
The two continue fighting on the merry-go-round going way too fast. There's some little kid on there just like
having a good time.
And an old man who comes out of nowhere crawls underneath the merry-go-round to go and shut it down so that the cops can get their two culprits. What ends up happening is this guy, I don't know what happens to the old guy or the kid.
Yeah.
I don't.
That's who I care about.
The old guy turns off the merry-go-round. And then there's this establishing shot of the merry-go-round where it, like, freaks out and, like, falls on its side. I don't know if the old guy made it, all right?
It like, doesn't seem like
He's done for. I don't know if the kid made it because the whole merry-go-round just sort of collapses.
Right.
So Guy is perfectly fine because I think he gets flung off the merry-go-round because he's sort of like holding on the edge as it's moving, and as it stops he sort of just flies off, so he doesn't get crushed by any horses or anything like that. He's just all right. So he goes to the police and they're like, all right, we're gonna turn you in. And he's like, no, the guy who like the man, I don't want to say guy considering it's his name, the man who like killed my wife is here. He's on the merry-go-round. So they start digging around. They find Bruno buried under a bunch of debris, horses, and man, what a way to go.
Yeah, that's a weird way to go.
But he's like, Bruno, I know that like the jig is up. You have to tell the cops that you have the evidence you were going to plant in your hand. Because, you know, so long as he still has that lighter in his hand, that's proof that Bruno is the one who did it. And Bruno's like, no, not doing it. You know it was you. You know you killed your wife. You were the one who did it. And the cops are like, well, yeah, I mean, he doesn't even have the evidence. And then Bruno dies, and his hand lets loose, and lo and behold, there's the lighter. And, you know, that's that. Yep. So our crime story dissolves, and the movie ends perfectly. As we cut to a scene with Guy, and his innocence has been established, His life is good. He's going to his next tennis match. Probably going to go hang out with some guys who aren't murderers.
Hopefully.
And he's sitting next to Anne. And sure enough, a man across the train that he's riding on asks him, "Hey, aren't you Guy Haines?" Which is one of the first things that Bruno says to him. Guy looks at his wife, and they get out of there. Because they're not doing this whole murder business again. And it ends perfectly.
It really is the perfect ending to this movie.
Brandon McCann?
Yes.
I think that's all there is to say about this movie.
I think so. I think we really exhausted this.
And we hope we didn't exhaust you, but if we did, hopefully Strangers on a Train will not. Yes. We'll post a link to that movie because it's one of those movies that you can just find for free on YouTube. I don't believe it's like illegal in any way. No. I think this is just one of those movies because of its age. Yeah. And certain copyright laws and such like that, that you get to watch it perfectly legal. So
also, we didn't post it, so that's not on us.
So we'll attach that to the tweets that post this episode. And if you don't like listening to us, check out the movie anyways. Which I'd be surprised if you got to this point, like 58 minutes in,
and you decided you don't like.
Now you decide you don't like this.
Yeah, that'd be weird. But thanks for sticking around.
We will provide you with more movies in the future, and we hope that you enjoyed this first episode. Brandon McCann, I feel like you should have the closing statement. I'm done talking.
Wow. Well, that's a lot of pressure, John Blynn. But thank you all so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed listening to two film fanatics ramble about one we really enjoyed. And have a great week, and keep watching those movies. Thank you.